that's been so sweet to me.
Welcome to On Mindfulness. On Mindfulness is a show here on KKRN and sponsored by the Shasta Resilience Project. And it's an offering where we engage with a range of people on topics related to mindfulness. There's always a resource for you, a practice within the show. And please come back to the archives on kkrn.org to check out some past shows. My name is Sharon Brasilera. I'm your host for On Mindfulness. And this morning, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Karen Karnatz, who also goes by Joko.
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here in this beautiful building with all these microphones. It's a happy place.
It is a happy place.
Yeah.
So we always start our conversations by asking our conversation partners to introduce themselves however they wish to ground our conversation.
Okay. Name is Karen Karnatz. I'm known around town. If you're in Redding, Shasta County, pretty well known as Karen. I also go by Joko, and so I don't want to confuse people. And you can choose whichever name that you like. Karen is my given name. Obviously, a little bit of a struggle in these times to carry this name. I wear it proudly, and I do always call the manager, but I try to like give compliments instead, and I really throw them off when I do that. So it's one of my favorite things. But Joko is a spiritual name. I practice an African traditional religion, and it was given to me in that practice. And it's important to me. It means something that is good for me to affirm. So I like to use that name, but I also know that a lot of people know me as Karen. So you choose.
One of the main reasons I wanted to have you here is to talk about the work that you do through Morning Space.
Morning, that's with a U.
Right, with the U.
Say sometimes.
That's a much easier way to say it, yeah. We've spoken on this show with grief tenders and death doulas and a lot of different things. And yet, there was so much new in your website and in your first aid kit that we'll talk about later that were really important grounding reminders. So I thought we'd start with sort of the origins of Morning Space, how that came about and what it is.
So Morning Space was just an online space for a few years where I wanted to approach conversations around death and dying and grief in a way that made the conversations approachable. I guess if I can sum up a whole career, I was a mortician for most of my adult life. I went to mortuary college when I was 18 in San Francisco. It's closed now, but it's in Sacramento if people want to attend. Started working in funeral homes and very quickly decided that this was felt like the right place for me to be. So I act as a funeral director, embalmer, crematory operator, manager, cemetery manager, eventually just all of the things that you can do in a funeral home and then eventually cemetery setting. Fast forward, I also am someone who is pretty driven as a person, pretty type A. So I did end up climbing a corporate ladder. I ended up working for a company when I lived in Lake County. So I'm from the Bay Area, moved to Lake County, worked for a company, transferred from Lake County up to here to Shasta County, managed funeral homes and cemeteries for quite a while, and then became a district manager, let's say over three states. As I was going along this, you know, trajectory, I got farther and farther away from the things that I really cared about, which is being with people when they're sad, helping people navigate all of the emotions one might experience, helping people understand the process a little bit better. So I started Morning Space actually during the pandemic, as people did, and really looked at their life and said, what is it now that I have this sort of world pause? What do I do with it? And I looked around knowing that in my work, seeing how culturally separate we can be from grief, we don't really talk about it too much. Or if we do, we have a certain narrative that we attach to it. And so that's already complicated when you've lost a person, which is the most maybe validated grief that one might experience. And then I looked around at the pandemic and I'm seeing all the ways life is changing. No matter what you believe about any of it, it is true that it was a pivotal moment in history that changed the way that we approach life. And we could no longer count on, if we were of a certain age and never really experienced something anything like that level of traumatic or life-changing, world-changing, everybody's lives changed, no matter what. And I knew that there would be a lot of grief attached to this time forever or ever. And I wanted to be in a place to be able to support people, not just grieving the loss of a person, which happened, you know, quite a bit at that time, but also the loss of just when our foundation is just rocked and we don't know when we feel alone in it, right? So I took a grief support specialist course at the University of Wisconsin, and then I took a death doula course at the University of Vermont, trying to hone those skills and started Morning Space at the same time. But it was difficult to manage the things I wanted to do through Morning Space while also balancing a career. So eventually one of the things had to go. And in October of last year was when I left completely the career I've had my whole adult life. And now I've stepped fully into Morning Space.
Mm-hmm. What a beautiful education into that, being able to witness and be with people in that moment for so long. It's really remarkable what you could come away with. I mean, I wonder what were some of your key learnings or how you see that?
I grew up through it all, right? As I'm started out as a kid, you know, being a kid, like 18's not very old, and to be in this, go into this business as an 18-year-old, just like your life drastically changes from teen to 20s to 30s, 40s, you know, which is where I am now. Mm-hmm. So I evolved, my understanding of everything evolved. However, I knew from moment one that I had to listen to what people were telling me. You have to be in a place to listen to people if you're working in funeral homes like that. You just, that's a skill you have to cultivate. And the more I watched other people grieve, the more I watched the traditions that people participated in. And I'm from the Bay Area. That was when I started, right? So many cultures represented. So I did Sikh and Hindu and Muslim and, you know, Buddhist, like any number of funeral services for different cultures. And they were really fascinating. I grew up Catholic. In fact, actually, this is a fun fact about me. I actually started working funerals when I was, I want to say 12, because I was an acolyte. I went to Catholic school and they would pull me out of class to work funeral masses during the day. So if there's a funeral mass, they needed an acolyte, they would call me out of class. So handful of times I would have worked a funeral mass at 12. And I remember being tipped $5 by a funeral director. And I was like, I won, you know. So it's actually funny when I go back how far I've actually been participating in this, you know. Watching the way people handle grief and death and dying and loss helped me shape my own beliefs over time. And I became so aware about how sacred that time is, how transformational it can be, how messy it is, but also how life is not ever not messy. I said this to someone recently. Like, if you went to a movie, you would never go see a movie where everything was great all the time and everybody was just happy. And at the end, it was like, look at how great everything was. Like, that's not an interesting movie. You wouldn't watch that. And right, that's sort of now how life is. Life has its ups and downs and stuff. And when you reflect back on your life, you're like, whoa, look what I lived through. Look at what I made out of the experience that I had. And so maybe that's kind of where I've been dropped off after everything that I've learned, is wanting to achieve this end of life when I look back and say, look at what I did. Like, and look at the people who supported me along the way. Look at the people who will live on after me, you know.
Your first aid kit has a part for, yes, ask for help. It's a human thing. It's something that you need right now. And here's some examples of how you can.
The first workbook I wrote was this workbook called Fire Under the Night Sky. And that was actually a tool to have a funeral for a part of yourself.
Oh.
And everybody saw that I wrote a workbook and knew what I did for a living. And so many people bought the workbook thinking that it would help you navigate grief or loss or whatever from a loss of a person. Let's say you're a smoker and you want to quit smoking. Let's say you are, you know, use food as a crutch and you want to get rid of that behavior. This helps you actually have a acknowledge that the why the behavior exists and have a little funeral for it. And then what you do after that is up to you. But anyway, so that's completely different.
Oh, I love that.
After I left my job, one of the first things I did was finish this griever's first aid so people would actually get the thing I think they thought they were buying, which is a resource to help people as they're grieving. Mm-hmm. And I made it a low cost, so it was a low barrier for people to access. And it's if I was able to get a hold of everybody in the first 30 days of loss, those are the quick things I'd want to relay to people. So mm-hmm. that's everything that I put together. It's kind of a smattering of things that would help you. And, you know, choose what works for you and what doesn't. But words fail people. Like, your bandwidth when you're grieving, it like goes to zero. So I try to remove barriers with a lot of what I do to try to just give you something so you don't have to think about it. So it gives people literal scripts on what to say to ask for help. Because people will – I have two educational wings that I go, like, one is educating grieving people and one is educating the people that support grieving people. So I want to say to the people supporting grieving people, don't make them think. You right. say to them, I'm going to bring you dinner. Is Tuesday or Thursday better? I would love to come clean your bathroom. Is it okay if I come Tuesday morning? I want to come walk your dogs for a week. Are you okay with that? Right. So maybe they have a couple decisions to make, but the thing they don't have to think about. If you open this door of, I want to help you. How can I help you? That makes them have to think about what do I want? I don't know what I don't know who I am today. So I don't know what I want. So the workbook does walk you through what might I need. Who can I ask? How do I ask for it if people bring it up or if I just really need help? And it's like, literally, this is what you say.
You have a non-denominational prayer. What for you is a prayer and the power of a prayer to someone maybe who doesn't, it's not rooted in a particular spiritual tradition?
What a question. I love this. Prayer is a funny one for me. I said I grew up Catholic, and then I was, maybe that's a thing that the kids do, is like, I'm nothing, I'm an atheist. And then I moved into maybe like, well, you know, how does one even know like what is real? And so I'll just be agnostic and I'll go wherever the good people go and, you know, whatever that is. So over time, my own spirituality has changed. And I remember being very angry when people would put religion on me. Working in funeral homes, there's a lot of religious practices, and generally they're going to assume that you are what they are. I didn't like being pigeonholed, and I Right. didn't like being told that you must not have hope. I never want to forget what it felt like to feel excluded from people's goodwill, sort of, or whatever assumptions about my soul. However, over time, I did end up coming a little bit back to the Catholic faith. And then, as I said, practice an African traditional religion called Ishéché Vlagba. And I've become someone who prays every day. You know, I have this thing now where I want to wake up and before I touch my phone, I want to go to a place in my house that is for prayers or meditation for all the things. And so I'm going there first and I'm saying my prayers and doing my things before I get on with my day. And I think speaking words out loud has power. It just is true. You know, no matter what you believe, there's so many things that there's a core of, no matter what you believe, it is true. Energy is true. You can't deny it. If someone is glowering at you from across the way and you, like, you feel that, like, there's no doubt whether or not you believe in woo stuff, like, someone's intention at you. You can feel,
mm-hmm. right? Or you walk into a meeting and people are angry.
Yeah, intense, you know, yeah. Anytime you walk into a room and you feel, that is real. And so if you pair this energy that you know is real and these words that you also know are you know, speaking your truth, using your voice, whatever, to call in whatever. If you pair those two things together, to me, that's prayer, saying things with intention, cultivating an energy. And one of the things I love most maybe is the meditation, you know, the loving kindness meditations.
Yes,
and
yes.
So this, like, maybe may you be safe, may you feel loved. You know, that to me is the basis of so many prayers.
Mm.
And if nothing else, I want people to feel safe. I want people to feel love. I want people to feel at peace. I want people to be seen. And so those are simple prayers that I might make that have nothing to do or everything to do with God. And we're not saying it, you know, right. Whatever it is. But I never want to alienate people who appreciate the energy and intention behind words spoken in reverence or intention.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Mary Oliver, the poet, also talks about prayer as attention, you know, attention to a person, to an experience, to nature.
Right.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to On Mindfulness, and I'm in conversation with Karen Karnatz, or Joko, of Morning Space.
Yeah.
What else do you offer through Morning Space that people should know about?
Mm. Primarily, it is for my death doula work. And you've said you've had death doulas on before. This is kind of an emerging, perhaps, concept, an emerging path that people are choosing to walk. My background and education makes me ideal for helping caregivers, in fact. Certainly, I want to support people as they're in a dying process, but the way I do that most effectively is by helping their family help them. My primary work is as a death doula, supporting caregivers as they support someone at the end of their life. I also am a funeral officiant or a celebration of life officiant or whatever it is that people want to call it. And that is actually the thing I would say I'm best at in all of the things I do. It's the medicine that I give to the world,
yeah.
I would say. And then I do grief support. So not a counselor, you know, don't have any of those, but I do know grief. I do know sad people. And I do respect the way that loss can be in anything. So loss of a relationship, loss of a pet, loss of just loss. And I don't want anyone to feel alone or like their grief is not validated. So this idea of disenfranchised grief, I want to be a franchiser of grief. You know, I want people not to feel like they're wrong or bad or need to get over it or whatever the lies that we tell ourselves are.
Mm-hmm.
So grief support is my kind of third post, I would say, on there.
Yeah. I love the language around validated because it can be, like you mentioned earlier, with COVID, we mourned a way of being, you know, during the time and that things would change. This mind-body medicine, which gave rise to this, was really a recognition that there's a lot of grief after the car fire, right? Our homes, our relationships, people moving away, the environment. And then there's a whole level of grief about what's happening in our world. For everything from democracy to war and genocide and that it's all legitimate. It's all, if we are experiencing that loss.
Yeah, everybody experiences things in a different way. And I feel bad, and especially, you know, when you come up with a maybe sibling group, right? So everybody's, it's a mom who's dying, let's say, and there's four siblings. And one is angry, and one is sad, and one is fixing everything, and one is like having fun. You know what I mean? And all are grieving.
Yes.
And everybody looks at each other and like, why aren't you? You know, like, but it's like, it's not, they came up with their own way over the course of their life of dealing with whatever it is that's happening. They have their own relationship with their parent that is unique to them versus, you know, the sibling set. So it can be really frustrating for a family when there's not a synchronicity of feeling. So having someone come in and just sit with all of it and everybody. And if I can, maybe broker some conversations. But if not, just be with everybody in their own space and validate, you know, whatever it is that they're feeling and however it is that they're navigating. And, you know, at some point, poke in there that sometimes just people are going to be different and we have to figure out what our response is to that and how much grace we give people, but also what boundaries do we need to create? And that's real. I'm a huge believer of creating and maintaining boundaries, and the people who respect your boundaries are the people that you want in your life.
Yes. That definitely stood out to me in your kit that there's those... Here's some scripts for asking help, and here's some scripts for saying no, which for some people are hard all of the time, especially when we're having all of these physiological responses. And that's one thing that people on the show we have not talked about that you do talk about is what to expect physiologically, cognitively, what happens when we're grieving. And that can come up again, like maybe it's been 2 years and as you say, like you smell something and then you start again. What are some of those somatic bodily cognitive things?
My friend says this and I love it. I'm crediting my friend Bridget, but she says that sort of time when you're in deep grief, like something has just happened, is when you're looking for your fork and it's in your hand. So it's just like that's how your whole life is. You know, you can't remember anything anybody said. You can't keep track of dates. You're in a daze. Your brain is like literally trying to find its hold and it's not there. Like everything it had to reach for is no longer available. And your brain gets trained, right, on its environment and prediction models. And so its prediction model is out of whack. So it can't predict now what's happening. And so you just fritz. Not sleeping too much, like headaches, body aches, like feeling sick, feeling heavy, nonstop crying, frustration that you can't cry. There's so many ways in your body that your grief may show up. And I think the key with that is to just know that's sometimes how grief shows up is just like manifesting in symptoms, right? And eventually, ideally, those symptoms fade over time. But I tell people often, we think that that time is 2 weeks, you know?
Right.
Like, maybe. Like, if we're not like 5 days, you know? But I feel like 2 weeks feels like this line where people are like, okay, get on with it. When I'm like right off the year, and I realize that easier said than done. I realize that we have a life to live and often kids to manage or careers to manage or whatever it is. We're never so lucky, rarely so lucky, real people to not have to, we often have to live full, busy, productive lives while also navigating grief, which to me is terrible, but is true. However, I feel like the first year is just, next year we'll see what happens. But this year, give yourself all the grace that you can for what you're able to do and expect that your bandwidth is lower.
That's a beautiful way to put it too, that it's that time is longer than you might imagine, and that to allow it, sometimes you have to let go of other things. Maybe you're not showing up for every big sale and bringing all the stuff.
For real. That's where we get into those no's. And then you'll see some people might go, well, but this might be good for you. Or they might say, but maybe we should get you out so you're not dwelling or whatever it is. And so it's up to us as grieving people to really look inside. Are we hiding from the world in a way that's unhealthy? Or are we hiding from the world in a way that says, I really can't, I need recharge time. This is not useful for me. So it is good for us to check in with those things and to get outside and to be with people, I think is a medicine that we should not discount, which is why I'm so big on if not the word funeral, then the act of having an event after someone dies. Mm. I'm a stickler.
I attended a celebration of life that you officiated, mm-hmm. that you led, and it was very beautiful and allowing. And I loved the rituals that were there. And I noticed that too in your website, that acknowledgement of bringing in rituals, moments that ground us, cultural values, things maybe that make us smile if that's what we want, but things as simple as tea or a light. Mm-hmm. And that's also something that's not heavily validated in maybe among more metaphysical, communities, mm-hmm. but more generally that has a gift for everyone. Mm-hmm.
I think what makes my funerals good is that, one, I've been to bad funerals. I've helped put on bad funerals, acting as a funeral director.
You've seen
I've seen a lot of them, and I understand that maybe we haven't done a great job in selling that word. In fact, we've done a terrible job showing people what a funeral could be. And so now I see this pivot to, I don't want a funeral. I want a celebration of life instead, because that feels like the total 180 against everything that a bad funeral might be. I'm on this mission to reclaim the word funeral. I also can let that go in the spirit of, I just think gathering when you've lost somebody is important. It is something we are naturally inclined to do as social creatures. And I saw that play out in COVID when people couldn't. And that messed with people's grief. You can read studies on it now of like the way that we weren't able to participate in funeral end of life rites in the same way, and how that really affected people negatively. But my funerals are true to the person. So the service that you attended was very much in line with what that person would have wanted and what their belief system was, whereas someone else's funeral is going to look totally different.
That's really nice.
Yeah. And I start by asking people just very practical bullet point stuff. And in one of those is, was there a faith? Is there anything within the faith that I need to know? Specifically, anything... are there scriptures or poems or acts or rituals or whatever that was important as a part of that faith that then I can incorporate? And some people, faith is not at all. I will do services for atheists, and mm-hmm. I still do them in a way that I believe is uplifting and honoring of, the person and gives them what they need. Generally, if you go to a church faithfully, you're going to have that church handle your services because it's very much in line culturally or spiritually with a practice that you already have and people you already know and a person in a leadership role that does those sorts of things. However, a lot of people don't have that. And then they go looking, who can do this for me? And I specialize in meeting people where they are.
Mm-hmm. Do you often hear that the funeral is for that gathering? It's mm-hmm. for the people. So mm-hmm. How do you balance those? Because certainly you're witnessing what that person, sort of the essence of that person.
Yeah, that's a great question. So as an example, I recently, participated in a very Catholic service. And I came in the night before. So what might be the wake, might think of as a wake or a vigil or a visitation? I did what I would might normally do as a whole service that evening before the next day, which was the funeral mass. And that was done intentionally. My time was more of storytelling, more eulogizing, more, just talking about the person. The mass was more, this is the ritual that we do when we participate in this practice for our own comfort, but also for the repose of our soul, right? So if we believe in this, like that's a very important thing that we believe we need to participate in order to participate fully and maybe, have the experience in the afterlife we want to have. I don't know, right? So you'll find people with very specific faith or beliefs, you're going to do that for them, right? So you're going to have the Catholic Mass for the person who went to church every Sunday. And also, you can incorporate the storytelling outside of a Mass structure. I will say that was one of the most beautiful services I've ever been to. They did it at a Carmelite, I want to say.
Like a convent?
Yeah, or monastery, convent. I can't remember where it was. It's in the Bay Area. And they had a quartet.
Beautiful.
And the priest quoted Star Wars, which is one of my favorite things. I have Star Wars tattoos. And I was like, whoa. Now, if I was going to have, like, this might be what I would want, right, to have that celebration of life incorporated. And that might be for the people who don't resonate so much with the Catholic Mass, right? So maybe they go to that part and not necessarily the Mass. But to have that paired with the most beautiful, and music to me is very important to me. That's been the most bizarre thing, I think, is learning that people don't have the same resonance with music, don't put any importance on music. I'm always a little baffled when people are like, no, they didn't listen to music. That might be like the weirdest thing for me. In fact, I try not to. Okay, well, we won't add music. We'll do something else. But to me, music is such a fundamental part of ritual.
Mm.
So anyway, that was just, I will keep that in my mind of one of my favorite services because it had all the pieces that would have been very important to that person. And it was all done beautifully and with intention.
If you're joining us just now, you're listening to On Mindfulness in my conversation with Karen Karnatz, or Joko. You spoke earlier about supporting caregivers. Mm-hmm. And there are also people around someone who has told you that they're dying, or you have a sense that they are not doing well, mm-hmm. Or someone who is grieving. Mm-hmm. For the person who's kind of, well, very close or on the periphery, there can be a lot of floundering around there too. Mm. Like, what's the best thing to do? What do I do? What do I not say? So, you know, you mentioned earlier, very specific, like be specific about something that you can offer or do for them with minimal choices. Mm-hmm. You also talked a little bit about that it seemed to me was an offering too of just being
with. Yeah.
What else would you offer to people?
Grief is a bunch of landmines.
It is.
And I want to acknowledge that it can feel impossible to say the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I encourage people to approach their grieving friends with the understanding that you may make an oops. And then we go into the idea of rupture and repair, which is we will always have ruptures in our relationships. Can we acknowledge them and work to repair them? So this grief time may be a time where you have to be real conscious about rupture and repair. With that said, you can only do your best. Basic rules. If the words at least start to come out of your mouth, shut your mouth. No good thing that you tell someone starts with at least. So just don't do that. Praying for people is very appropriate if you know that they pray. Like, I belong to several spiritual groups, right? And we ask for prayer. We would expect prayer. We would expect, if we're going through something, for our friends to come and say, well, we're going to pray for you. So that's very appropriate. If you don't have that relationship with people, maybe you don't lead with prayer.
Or if that's not something that they want.
Yes, right. So if you know they don't want it, don't do it. If you are unsure, but that's not your relationship with them, that's not the first place I would go. Pray for them. Go ahead on your own time. You don't have to tell them. You don't have to ask them. I mean, I get that consent is important, but if you're silently praying at your home for someone's peace and, you know, ability to get through this time, great. You've done it. I do believe in being very specific. I also believe this can be tricky. And I say this with love. Know your place. Some people are in the inner circle. Some people are not. So if you're not in the inner circle, maybe you don't offer inner circle things.
Yeah, tell me more. Some of those are inner circle things.
Yeah, and so I just remember someone dying, and like that day or the next day, someone in the periphery was like to the husband, you know, I want to take you out to dinner. And it's like, no, that's not the right thing in that moment. Like, that's not the relationship level that you're at. And that's not maybe the appropriate thing. Can I send you, you know, a gift card for a meal is probably the level that's appropriate for that. Right. In that moment, that person is probably around all of the people that like are in the daily life. Right. Like the immediate family, there's a lot to do or think that there's a lot to do. Or just, you know, hovering too much, you know, like trying to be, there is it's so tricky. It is this balance and you're not going to get it right necessarily. Right. So just be ready with the apology, but you know, not have like, and not asking like what happened. I don't want people to, like, so some people want to be asked what happened. Right. And I listen to people and I understand that there are many ways to approach it. In general, if someone doesn't tell you what happened, it's because it's not your business. And if you are present and it comes up, like that's appropriate. You can say, you know, or something you may try to say. I don't try not to say like you should do this or that, but something you can try is like, you know, I'm here to talk about whatever it is that you want to talk about. You know, if you want to talk about them, great. If you want to talk about what you've been through, great. If you want to talk about comedy, great. Like, what do you want to, I'm here for you. And that opens the door for them to speak without you saying, tell me what happened. You know, because one's a little nosy and one's, let me be with you in this time and let you share what you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Sharing, right? But, you know, DoorDash, you may love, you may not, but I will tell you it's one of my favorite things for people who are sad because it's a way for me to do something without being in someone's face. Flowers are great. I mean, I actually love, I mean, whether or not you, whatever you feel about flowers and like during a funeral service, maybe there's too many of them, but you know, there is this sort of medicine, I think, in beautiful things around that smell good and just add to your senses. So, can be appropriate. I love like tea and water. People may just not feel like eating at all, you know? And so what can we give them that at least helps them a little bit. And so I like things like that is to give people, but just tread lightly, but also little drops in, right? Don't give up if they don't respond to you. And I've made this mistake. Like people think that just because I talk about this and live it, that I'm great at it. I'm not great at it. I remember a friend's parent died. And I figured they would just know that whenever they want help, you know, I'll be around. And catching up later, it was like, you weren't there for me. I was there for you in my mind. Like,
right,
you know,
right.
And to be fair, it is exhausting. Like we may have a lot of connections. And so trying to maintain all of the connections to all people all the time is difficult. But also I felt bad that I had let a friend down in that way, that I hadn't put my little drop in of just like, hey, thinking about you if you want to go for a walk, you know what I mean? So even like schedule it in your phone, like once a week, like, hey, I'm thinking about you. And maybe not at the same so I can always have an example of like when that worked and when it didn't work. Right. Also, which is my struggle, because sometimes it'll get like a little trigger if you're still reminding. So just like, anyway,
but showing that you're present. The other thing underlying, or what I'm hearing and underlying what you're saying, is that be in touch if you're the one reaching out with yourself. And because I have witnessed people who are showing up in part because of their own discomfort, or they're wanting to I want you to know that I'm here for you.
Yes.
And so needing their own validation, mm-hmm. right? When sometimes you're going to be cranky if you're grieving mm-hmm. or not going to say things the right way either.
Right. You know? Yeah. This is another thing that is important. And so, again, it's so random. I had another friend who lost a parent and they didn't talk to me for a long time. Like, I would reach out. I would put in my drops. No response. A few months later, it was like, thank you so much. I knew you were the one person that wouldn't be upset with me because I did not have any bandwidth to talk. It's like so many people wanted to talk, wanted things, or finalizing estate, all this stuff. Like, so many hands grabbing. They knew that I was just dropping. Mm. And when they were ready, they could come back around. And they were really grateful for the space that I gave them.
Beautiful.
So just have that as a reminder. It's nice to be the person that doesn't need, the person that's there but doesn't need that.
Yes.
And eventually that may be, they may be, you may be who they come to when they do need something then at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they, you were patient and gave them grace to deal with whatever they were doing without and I will say also, it that doesn't mean that at some point I didn't go, was it me? Like, did I do something? Or, sure. You know, am I too hard to deal with or be around? Because that is an occupational hazard.
Right.
Sometimes I remind people that someone has died and it's, they look at me and start crying. And so it's like, maybe, you know, it's that situation. And so there is a little bit of like, did I? And also, I, you know, if I did, we'll figure that out. Otherwise, sure. And then I didn't. So it was great.
You know, often on the show, we do a practice, a mindfulness practice.
Oh, right.
And I'm wondering if you have one for us that we could do together. We don't have to.
I should have been ready for this one. You know, I think that this is probably a common one. Of, you know, what your senses, you know, tapping into your senses. But I do think it's probably common because it's very useful, right? So if you're spiraling in your mind and you are having a hard time taking a breath, if you are having a hard time, if you're just in a loop that you can't get out of, you know, taking a moment, feeling where you're seated, feeling where you're standing, maybe you put your hand on your chest and on your belly. You close your eyes. And you listen. You focus on what you can hear. Noticing if there are pleasant sounds, unpleasant. And then feeling the touch of your hand on your chest, on your belly. Feeling your chest rise and fall, or maybe noticing that it isn't and breathing into it so you can feel that movement. Feeling the rise and fall of your belly. Noticing the inside of your mouth. Is there toothpaste? Last thing you ate? Is it a pleasant taste? Is it unpleasant? Without judgment, but just noticing. Noticing what you smell, but also feeling the air enter into your nose. Are there pleasant smells, unpleasant smells? Being with your body in this moment, feeling sensations in your body. Asking to detach from the mind and into the present moment. And at any time that your mind tries to take you to someplace unpleasant or some memory or an imagined future or shoulds, coming back to what's happening in this moment right now. What can I hear? What do I smell? What can I taste? Can I feel my body under my hands? Feel the ground under my feet. And knowing that we can always have this practice wherever we are, and it's portable. You can do it in the car. You can do it in the bathroom. You can do it in a closet. Sometimes we can take 5 minutes. Maybe it's not enough, but something. When you're ready and you've found your mind a little quieter, coming back into your body, finding movement, remembering to breathe, and knowing that if things get overwhelming, you can always go back to that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You told me earlier that you're always learning and engaging in formal as well as informal education, and that you're bringing on new modalities, you know, for the future and new offerings. So I wanted to ask you about what you have coming up in the future.
So during my life and as I'm evolving as a person, I guess psychedelics came into my awareness, and the way that they can be life-changing, and particularly for people at the end of their life when they're grappling with what that means and all of the fear, and then for their families as well, who are also grappling with all of that fear and resistance, right? So I feel like many people were introduced through Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. That was Oprah interviewed him, right? So that was my first real introduction, I want to say, is reading that book. And then I think there was a series on Netflix. But they touch on using these at the end of someone's life and the improved outcomes that happen based on that. So as I was exploring my own feelings on that, you know, subject and modality, I ended up taking some classes, some certifications on what that could look like as me as a sitter, practitioner, helper. And I ended up focusing on ketamine under the auspices of what you would call ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, not as a clinician, right? So I'm not performing psychotherapy. I'm not a psychotherapist, but I take classes that educators or that clinicians would take to learn more about ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. And there are some death doulas who are utilizing this in their practice. So that will be something that I do end up adding to my practice, is sitting with people who have prescriptions for ketamine. So I'm not, this isn't for everybody. This isn't for having fun, you know. But it's research-based. It's
supervised.
And it's supervised and it's prescribed.
Yes.
So
yes.
You've gone to a physician. A physician has said that this is an appropriate tool for you. And then I can sit with people and discuss the preparation ahead of time, sit with them during their session, and then help them integrate what they've learned afterwards. Yeah. So that's one. And then actually what I have now also made available to people, which we don't find much of here in Shasta County, is assistance with people who choose medical aid in dying. And that was a journey for me to, maybe it's this Catholic upbringing, you know, I had a lot of resistance to medical aid in dying. And I knew it was, I knew what it was. I didn't much look into what availability was in California. It didn't even occur to me to check if it was legal or not. Like, you know, I just know it's a thing. And I, if to me, it was for other people, but then I had the opportunity to help someone. And I learned that everything that I've learned up until this point makes me ideal at helping someone through that journey. Mm. And it did take a lot of, you know, self-reflection of whether or not I thought I could do well and help others, right? I didn't want to bring any baggage into you know, someone's experience. But the more I looked into it, the more I learned about it, the more I realized that this is actually a place where I can do a lot of help, where I can bring a lot of peace or hand-holding or whatever it is that I need to do for people, for not just the person who's chosen this, but for their families. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's been legal in California for 10 years. 10 years.
Wow. 10 years.
And actually, it was about to sunset, so they were going to kind of end it, and they ended up not sunsetting it. And that was, I want to say, in January of this year.
Wow.
So it's been sort of renewed as an option. But it's really elaborate. Like, it's not for everybody. You have to be dying. You have to have a terminal illness, 6 months or less to live. Two physicians have to sign off on you. There's waiting periods in between the times that you talk to physicians. You have to request in person and in writing. You have to be mentally capable to make this decision. So there's just so much that goes into it. So it's not something that you just go, I don't feel like living anymore.
Right.
Someone give me medicine. That's not the way that it works.
Right.
And some people actually, you know, people with dementia, let's say, who may be struggling towards the end of their life because they can't understand what they can't make their own choice in that moment. You know, they don't get access to that. And so people have different feelings, but in general, this is someone who's made this choice because they don't want to live the last 6 months or less of their life suffering or in a way that isn't aligned with the life they want to be living.
And you have a tiny legacy project?
I do have a tiny legacy project. So all the work that I do is all comes back to living better, more authentically. Easier said than done sometimes. I want to acknowledge the trauma that people live through and the horrible atrocities that are happening in this world. And also all the choices that we get to make every day when we don't have that experience or because we are having that experience. You know, Viktor Frankl, we can read his book and, you know, we have a choice. Sometimes in, well, we always have a choice in how we respond, I suppose, right? But as a eulogy writer, as a person who gets to hear about people after they're gone, I came up with a way for you to live the life that you want people to talk about when you die. Now, whether or not people say this, you have no control over. I love Hamilton, who lives, who dies, who tells your story. We don't know. We don't know if your story is going to become a musical in a couple hundred years. But what we do have control over is the life we hope that people can recount. So Tiny Legacies is a project where I walk you through deciding who you want to be at the end of your life. What do you want people to say? And it would be like, I was a person who made people laugh. I was a person who was a caregiver. I was, you know, you're going to say the things that you hope at your funeral the people would say. And then as you're living your life, when you have this written out, you can say, I have a choice to make here. Like, do I go this way or this way? Which way takes me to the thing I want people to say when I die? That's the choice you make.
Mm.
So it's a compass to help you live more authentically to the life that's important to you, to your values, and to the ways that you want to be remembered. And you can do that in little choices, like, do I say this thing or not say this thing? Which one is aligned with the person I want to be? And I do this so people, so often people decide to make changes in their life when they're faced with mortality, either someone else's mortality or their own. And then they go, oh, I haven't been living the life I want to live. I'm reminded to make changes. So this is a tangible way for you to practice that and define it and then live towards it. And it's a living document. you know, your values change over time. You know, you may not have a family right now, and then later on you do have a family and you have to change it. And that's, to me, that is a part of living. It's a little meandery, but keep going back to it. Keep redefining what your compass is and keep going in that direction. And then at the end, maybe people say those things, maybe they don't, but you've lived them, which means that you've lived the life that you want to live. You live the thing that's most important to you. And I want everybody to do their tiny legacy.
Yeah. Sign me up. We're going to talk about how we can bring that to more people.
Yeah.
As we end, is there anything that remains to be said? Anything that I didn't ask you about that you'd like to share, or anything that's bubbled up besides where people can find you online?
Mm. Because this is a timely thing, death doulas are becoming more into people's awareness. So I want to encourage people, if they feel like it's something that they want to know more about, then they should absolutely lean into that curiosity. I think all of us need more death and dying and grief literacy. So I would love for everybody, I would love for it to be a high school course on like how to deal with grief, you know. But just be aware that there's a lot of people who are now exploring their interest in it and then taking a course, and then I'm a death doula now. Well, it comes with time.
Right.
It comes with experience. Right. And so you may just go and learn so that you can be a better friend and a better family member. And you may go and do it because you want to offer it more broadly to your community. And then you may go because you want to do it, you know, at scale, or you want to, you know, help other people.
Mm-hmm.
So just be mindful if you are interested in it. It could just be an interest that just makes you better at handling these things, and not necessarily like you have to own the title of a death doula.
Mm-hmm. Or if you're searching for one to have that
conversation. Or if you're searching for one, have that conversation to make sure they're the one that's right for you. And I would also say death doulas specialize in different things. Right. Some people say, like, this is the thing I'm best at. Right. This is the thing I'm best at. The thing I'm best at is helping caregivers and collecting stories to tell at services. Like, that's the thing I'm best at. So if you're looking for something else, like, you may ask around, like, if this is exactly what I need, maybe I go to this other person versus you. Right. So, yes, that's a thank you for pointing that out.
Yep. And where can people find you online?
People can find me online at morningspace, MORNINGSPACE.com. I'm also on all the social media platforms. So Instagram probably most often, although social media.
Right.
It's a struggle sometimes, but I like to be on it. And I do put meditations on my YouTube channel as well. And you can find that, access that through the website.
Perfect. Well, Karen, Joko, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And everyone can check out the archived version for some of those links. Check out her website, and hopefully we'll see you back here on Mindfulness for our next conversation. If you are able, please do support this station. Our theme music is provided by Rachel Beck of Omnificent.
Don't you want me to be happy? Don't you want me to be unafraid? Don't you want me to follow all my dreams? Don't you want me away?